From WHQR Public Media, this is The Newsroom. I'm Ben Schachman. Thanks for joining us. On today's show, we're going to be talking about the work of Strengthening Systems for NC Children, or SSINC. It's a state-funded program that brings together experts from education, social services, law enforcement, and other government and nonprofit fields. In the most general sense, SSINC is looking to find better ways to take care of children. Now, that involves a lot of different agencies and organizations, many of which are often focused on one particular issue, or they lack the funding to scale up from a specific program or region. And for that reason, SSINC examines ways to help these organizations see some of the bigger picture. It hopes to help people see how many issues, like a child's behavior in the classroom and how available, nutritious, affordable food is in their neighborhood, are deeply interrelated, even if those two issues are treated as separate problems by separate nonprofits or agencies. The program rolled out in three counties, including New Hanover, where about 20 members convened over about 5 to 6 months. And my colleague Rachel Keith was invited to join them based on her deep reporting on ACEs, or Adverse Childhood Experiences. And understanding ACEs is really crucial to understanding SSINC's work. We'll have links on the show page to some of Rachel's past reporting, but basically, ACEs are some of the traumatic experiences people have in childhood, ranging from various forms of abuse and neglect to environmental issues like crime or poverty in their neighborhood, as well as food and housing insecurity. And these aren't just anecdotal connections either. Back in 1998, the CDC published a seminal paper showing how ACEs, if left unaddressed, can lead to seriously negative health outcomes, like cancers, depression, stroke, type 2 diabetes, and overall shortened life expectancy, conditions that cost billions of dollars to combat. The crucial caveat here is if left unaddressed. Studies show that you can counteract ACEs with what some experts call protective and compensatory experiences, or PACEs. If you've heard stories about people who pulled themselves through a traumatic childhood because of a loving parent or a mentor or a group, maybe a sports team or a band or a club, those are PACEs. But the most advanced level of work with ACEs is reducing and preventing them from taking a toll on children in the first place. That means taking a hard look at issues like violence, poverty, lack of economic opportunities, and other deeply entrenched issues. These are the toughest challenges facing our communities, and there's not always agreement on how to tackle them. But helping to get a shared understanding of what these problems are and who has which resources to help address them is a good place to start. Now, some of this is heady stuff, but as we'll talk about today, SSINC is geared towards creating some practical, usable results. And to help me unpack all of this is my colleague, Rachel Keith. So Rachel, thank you for being here.
Thank you.
Okay, so we're talking about SSINC, or Strengthening Systems for NC Children. Tell me a little bit about your involvement in this and what all this is.
Yes. So I was invited to be part of a 20-some person working group, and it was convened of all these different professionals from New Hanover County, and it was a wide range of people from government, Novant, NHRMC, Link, DSS, HHS, PD, UNCW, and the private sector. So we were all convened in August through December to brainstorm and talk about things, variables, factors that affect, that contribute to ACEs or potentially lessen the effects of ACEs. So basically, with SSINC, the North Carolina Division of Public Health's Injury and Violence Prevention Branch, along with UNC Chapel Hill's Injury Prevention Research Center, gave this grant to New Hanover County, to Surrey County, and to Franklin County to convene these working groups. And at the end, I believe it will be later this summer, where there will be a comprehensive report with all of the research done by the groups in these counties.
Now, this was a big group, but there was like a core team who you also brought into the studio to talk to. Tell me about the core team here.
Yes, the core team, who are now going to be doing a lot of the legwork into this 2025 year after the working group convened, they are Javene Skiba. She is the director of the New Hanover County Resiliency Task Force. Shaquana Pulliam of Open Gate, the Domestic Violence Shelter and Prevention Services. She's a prevention specialist. We have Keisha Robinson of Communities and Schools of the Cape Fear, and she is a program program manager. And then we also have Rebecca Martin, and she spent a long time at the Carousel Center, and now she is the director for a state chapter nonprofit called Not Today.
Gotcha. All right. So let's move into, you know, some of the issues you guys discussed. Now, one thing I think was helpful about this, and it's also the reason you were invited, right, is that there's been more reporting and more public conversation about what ACEs are. We'll have links to your series. But they asked you to join this group because you'd done so much reporting on it. But one of the good things was, you know, people kind of understood that part of it. And now the question was like, what do we do with that?
That's right. And the group worked together, and we'll talk about some more of the concrete steps that they want to take. But they were really focusing in around maternal health, around schools, and around community violence, but shifting the focus to community wellness. But we have Keisha Robinson of Communities and Schools, and she's talking about the diversity in this group.
It's not that the group didn't understand that ACEs exist. That's one of the beautiful things about the different agencies in this community, is that everyone knows, for the most part, what ACEs are and how they're impacting our community, but not everyone knows what they can do about it. So we get a lot of those big symptoms. We're seeing a lot of behavior issues in the schools. We're seeing teacher burnout, those types of things, but they are simply symptoms of the issue, which is the ACEs, and which is the trauma that our community, our environment, our members are suffering from.
So another part of this is that ACEs are things we might have once thought about as being, you know, limited to a few unfortunate people in the community, but there's really a much broader understanding of who's been impacted by ACEs now.
Yes, I think the statistic that CDC gives is in 25 states, about 61% of Americans have at least one, and we talked about what those were in the introduction. But Javanae Skiva, she's talking about, again, ACEs affects most of us, and most of us working out in the community will see it. And again, it's not an us versus them. It's kind of our community that we have to deal with.
Not one person who is in an organization, living or working in a community, operates outside of the effects of adverse childhood experiences or trauma. And we see this because we all have concerns about safety in our schools and in our public institutions, right? We all have concerns about equity and inclusion. We all have concerns about workforce development and how people show up to work, or if they don't show up to work. And all of those things can be traced back to someone's experience of trauma or an adverse childhood experience, or more than one.
Now, I know when some people hear the phrase equity inclusion, the hair is going to go up on the back of their neck,
yeah.
Either because they're strongly opposed to DEI programs or because they're in favor of them and they feel like opposition to that will shut this process down. But I want to say something real quick here, and that is that there are probably some pending legal challenges to the hiring practice part of DEI. You know, the Harvard admissions case, probably the opening salvo in what will likely be a series of Supreme Court or federal court cases where we look really closely at, can you consider someone's race when you hire them? And a lot of people on the conservative side of the aisle make the argument that hiring should always be a meritocracy. It should never be based on race. And that in fact, would be racism to do that. But that's a debate for a different show. I think it's worth saying that a lot of what DEI has done when I've looked at the programs, and the DEI that I've been involved with as a manager, as someone who hires people, has a lot more to do with office culture and how you create a space for your employees. And the inclusivity part of that includes things like veteran status, pregnancy, national origin, mental health, disability. It goes so far beyond race. And so thinking about, you know, what makes someone feel like they're a part of a company or part of a government organization or part of a nonprofit, and what makes them feel like they have the same chances to do good work and advance as anyone else, I think that's pretty important, and I think people have less of a problem with that.
Yeah, and I witnessed this group working together, and they all work in the community, and they want to help people. They want to see people for who they are and recognize their place in the world, and they want them to feel welcome so that they can grow and they can pursue better and positive opportunities for themselves. And that's the goal here, what they were talking about.
Okay, so I want to move on to the way this group was thinking about the problem of ACEs which is at kind of a big environmental, ecological, kind of big picture way. So tell me about this. They call it systems thinking.
Yeah, systems thinking. And one of the big components that they asked the group to do in each of the counties is to make a causal loop diagram. Okay, just imagine this big web, and you have all these different variables and factors. And when you're talking about schools, okay, if we have a large number of suspensions, what does that mean? How would that impact the community? And so it's really drawing from what helps decrease suspensions, what helps increase them, you know? So looking at, you know, the effects of the thing that we do in our society. So it's this huge map, and we have, again, one for maternal health, for schools, and for community violence. And so these maps, you will see, it looks like a system, because it's not just someone misbehaving in the school. It's something very big. There are so many factors that go into a misbehaving student. And what are those? And it could be a kid being a kid, but if it's consistent and chronic over time, there are going to be some major layers that you peel back behind that student who's misbehaving.
Right. One of the things we were talking about off mics before the show is that, take for example, an organization like Communities in Schools, which does things like provide mentorship for students in school, they might see a student who's misbehaving. What they might not see, right, is the kid didn't have breakfast in the morning because they're a latchkey kid who's making their own breakfast, or the family's dealing with poverty, or they're in a food desert and the food they do have in the house is, you know, short burst of sugar, and then they're feeling pretty crappy an hour later. But all of that is kind of like in a different silo, right? It's,
yes.
It's not on their radar as that one organization.
When we look at these big systems, it can be siloed, and Javen A. Skiba of the Resiliency Task Force is saying that they want to bridge that.
I think part of what keeps folks from collaborating effectively or understanding what their role might be, could potentially be in a collaboration, is lack of systems thinking. And systems thinking requires folks to kind of look at root causes. And oftentimes we are trained to look very specifically at the issue that our organization is trying to solve, which is not necessarily a bad thing. But what we find, a lot of the issues that we are trying to solve aren't happening in vacuums. And what we are doing is more intervention.
And Keisha Robinson of Communities in Schools kind of drives this point home more concretely.
Yeah, this is a great analogy. I like this.
I think that looking at systems thinking or just the systems mindset is the body analogy. So something going on in the brain is going to affect every other part of the body, or something going on in the lungs can affect every other part of the body. Nothing in the body operates in a vacuum. So when we think of our community as a body, we have to understand that something that goes on in the education sector is not just in the education sector. So we're going to see that show up with, you know, parents that have to clock into a job if they're concerned about the safety of their children at school. That's going to show up in those parents and their ability to do their job well.
Right. So just like in the human body, you know, you might have a mental health issue, might actually be related to your gut health. You might have a lymph node issue related to your dental health. You know, it's much more complicated.
Yes. And, you know, it's hard for us as human beings to get beyond the symptom and look behind it. And trying to figure that out is why this group convened, is peeling back the symptom, what's behind it.
Okay, well, we need to take a quick break, but we're going to come back to this issue and talk about some of the resistances to this way of thinking about things. I'm Ben Shockman, here with my colleague Rachel Keith. You're listening to The Newsroom. Stay with us. Welcome back to The Newsroom. I'm Ben Shockman, here with my colleague Rachel Keith. Rachel, thanks for being here.
Thank you.
We've been talking about strengthening systems for NC children, a group that Rachel was a part of, and they've been trying to take a broader systems thinking look at ACEs and the issues caused by ACEs here in New Hanover County. And there is a lot of value in thinking about things this way, but that doesn't mean it's without pushback.
That's right. And I wanted to bring this idea up to the core team because we've heard it. Critics have said, okay, well, if someone's misbehaving or not doing what they're supposed to do, that's on them. And so are you kind of throwing away individual accountability, or can ACEs be something that someone has an excuse for? I have this, and so I can't do this. And I asked Javenay Skiba about this.
And, you know, there's an opportunity for that to grow into, or we're losing all personal accountability. And that is not the case.
Right.
We are really examining how we expand personal agency. We forget that trauma and stress are true inhibitors of our growth and our ability to learn, to develop pro-social behaviors. When we are constantly activated, when someone is in survival mode, then that is the part of their brain that is going to call the shots in their interactions throughout life. When we tone that survival mode down by offering more self-agency, because we have a language of resilience, we have an understanding and awareness of ACEs, and we actually employ practices and lead with policies and procedures that are human-centered.
You know, one of the places I hear some of the sharpest criticism about the use of ACEs as an explanatory model is when it comes to crime and community safety. People see someone arrested for a crime and they think that these theories let them off the hook. And over the last month, I've actually had a chance to talk to two very different people about this. Our district attorney, Jason Smith, who's coming at it from a more conservative law and order point of view, and Abdul Hafid bin Abdullah, who's taking a very public health, community health worker approach to this. I kind of asked them the same question, like, do you think these theories let people off the hook? And they both said no. You know, it is a balance. So in the criminal justice system, we have specialty courts for veterans who might be dealing with PTSD or other trauma, people dealing with drug addiction, people dealing with early pregnancy or, you know, single mothers. And from Abdullah's point of view, you know, he's looking at the, you know, social determinants of health, which is also sometimes the economic determinants of health. But the root causes of why people made the choice they made. They both said, hey, if someone breaks the law and they hurt someone, they need to be held accountable. But if you want to understand why they did that, you're going to have way better outcomes in the long run.
And if you make that attempt, it seems like when we talk to these experts that there's less of that recidivism, that they can go back, that they've been rehabilitated, that there are other options than going back to that. And that's hard work. And, you know, when we talk about law enforcement or teachers or social workers or doctors and nurses, they are on the front lines of dealing with a lot of these symptoms that arise. And we've talked about on the past that people who provide these services, they have to put their oxygen mask on first so that then they can be ready, calm, to deal with people in crisis and how important that is. So this is what Javenay is. She is talking about, of Javenay Skiba of the Resiliency Task Force of New Hanover County, is not, again, excusing the behavior, but let's look at why, and then how can we move forward to not have this happen again? Or can we be more open in with someone who's having a crisis than just calling law enforcement, this person, we got to get them out of here? Or are we going to help them?
I think we forget sometimes, and going back to systems way of thinking, when systems are oppressive, and I mean that very concretely, not abstractly, when I go to a doctor's office and I'm not able to access the care that I need because I don't have the skills to communicate that, and, you know, I'm you know, asked to leave, or I'm not treated in a way that is more inviting because I might appear threatening, but it's really I just don't have those skills, right? So with trauma-informed practices, we allow people to kind of come as they are and build that trust so that they want to access services, and then they can grow from there.
And so, again, it's this dance, and that's what the Resiliency Task Force works on with people, is like, how do I make sure I'm okay so I can take care of someone who isn't okay, and kind of hang in there with them so that they can get the help that they need. And Shaquana Pulliam of Open Gate, she talks about how, you know, detrimental that can be if someone is written off or ignored. You're kind of, the problem will continue and you're not getting at the root of the issue.
A lot of times, if people don't feel that they are, they have experienced any of that stuff or they're not aware of it, then they remove themselves from the issue and it becomes a them problem, not a my problem. And that lack of understanding takes away from how the overall overarching impact of trauma can really impact our community.
I mean, you could see how this would apply in so many fields. As a journalist, you could see how it would impact your ability to tell someone's story faithfully. As a doctor, you could see how, you know, some level of empathy or cultural competency would keep you from missing some pretty clear indicators of, you know, maybe a disease vector that you wouldn't have noticed otherwise. As a police officer, it might put you in a situation where you could de-escalate something without, you know, it becoming a violent situation or a lethally violent situation. So there's so many different ways you can kind of apply this thinking.
And when we talk to people, a lot of times when they're not doing those things, it's patience, it's time, it's money, that they just don't have the resources to be that open. But I mean, I think what the Resiliency Task Force is working on is to build those skills. Maybe you don't have all of those resources, but how can you give that person the attention when they're there in crisis so that they can get the help they need?
Yeah, and it's worth noting, you know, there is no one field where we only see this. You know, we see teachers saying, hey, we need help doing this. We see cops saying, like, hey, you're asking us to be frontline mental health responders. We need help doing this. We're seeing nurses saying, hey, we're seeing staffing cuts. We could use some help doing this. So, you know, there's just a lot of different ways that this manifests and a lot of different nonprofits that are only really focusing on, like, one tiny piece of this.
That's right. And that's the system, right, that you're looking at. Do they have the resources in the system to be available to someone who needs them?
Yeah. All right. Well, we need to take a quick break, but we'll be back with more about the systems thinking and whether nonprofits have to focus on what we call band-aid work or get to some of these deeper roots. It's complicated. We'll get into it. I'm Ben Shockman here with my colleague, Rachel Keith. You're listening to The Newsroom. Stay with us. Welcome back to The Newsroom. I'm Ben Shockman, here with my colleague Rachel Keith, and we've been talking about strengthening systems for North Carolina children, and the program that was run here in New Hanover County included you, Rachel, so you're here to help us kind of unpack some of the work they were doing and some of the issues they were working through. And one of, like, the real central problems they had to deal with is this issue of band-aid work versus root work. What does this mean?
Yes. And this, again, this was convened a group of 20 people, and they were from various different sectors, private, government, nonprofit. And they all feel sometimes that they are siloed, that their efforts are not coordinated. And they also say they feel like they're just doing intervention work, which is the band-aid work, which is someone's in crisis. I got to help them now, get housing, get transportation, get food, get support at school. It's usually, again, a crisis point. And Keisha Robinson of Communities and Schools talks about this. And you can hear Javenae Skiba of the Resiliency Task Force respond to what she's saying.
And even with the band-aid work, a lot of times we are forced into that because who we're serving is in an immediate crisis.
Right.
You got to deal with the crisis right before I can deal with what happened 10 years ago that led to this kind of thinking that led into the crisis. Mm-hmm. But first, I got to get you fed. Right. So with the whole give a man a fish or teach a man to fish, do both.
Exactly.
Give him the fish.
Exactly.
And then teach him when he's not hungry anymore.
And that's part of collaboration is while I am putting the band-aid on, who has my back to help me figure this out, mm-hmm, like a long-term solution while I'm applying pressure and stopping the bleeding?
You know, this is a conversation I hear all the time in discussions about the nonprofit world, and there's kind of a disparaging term used for some nonprofits, the self-licking ice cream cone. But it is a nonprofit that is never going to solve the root cause, usually because they're just focused on putting on Band-Aids. And an example I often hear is, you know, imagine there's a nonprofit that provides services for people dealing with cancer, you know, either palliative care for people at the end of their life or trying to make children who have cancer comfortable. We would never make fun of that work. That work's incredibly important and very meaningful to real people. But it's never going to cure cancer if that's all they're doing, right? At some point, we would hope someone would do either the research into how to cure that cancer or even maybe further up the river, right, of public health, figure out, you know, what was causing this cancer in the first place. Maybe it's an environmental toxin. Maybe it's alcohol. Maybe it's, you know, something in our food supply. Who knows? But if you are just doing the Band-Aid work, even though you're not solving cancer, it is pretty clear to people what you're doing. You know, oh, man, look, we raised this much money this year and we helped this many patients. It's pretty easy to explain. If you're spending 10 years, you know, researching gene therapy or two generations trying to change people's personal behavior so that they are less likely to get this cancer, it's harder to explain to people what you're doing. And people look at you like, hey, what, we donated money. What are you doing?
Right. And a lot of these large problems, societal problems, are not quick turnarounds, right? And a lot of times when money is given, for example, a grant is given, you are supposed to do X. That is what you're supposed to do. And it's not, sometimes it does systems thinking with that problem, but sometimes it's very concentrated. And that's, of course, they're supposed to be doing that. But again, the goal of this group and the goal of this approach that, you know, this group wants to take hold in the county is that we are, like Javonay Skiba said, like we're looking at long-term solutions while also stopping major crises in our community. And are we doing that? And this is a first step, is to transfer instead of the siloing into something larger. And we haven't heard yet from Rebecca Martin, but she was also part of the core team, and she has spent most of her career in helping children who have been sexually abused. And she still contracts with the Carousel Center here. And she is now one of the leaders of Not Today, which is a nonprofit that helps with prevention services of child sexual abuse. And again, it's hard when you open a nonprofit and you focus on interventions. But where is the prevention, which is the root work? So that can be pretty difficult. And here's Rebecca.
There's a tremendous amount of gaps that are very difficult to fill whenever you are talking about prevention in the United States. So they are specifically looking to help fill those gaps.
And what are some of those?
So funding is always a huge one. You know, just historically, prevention is always kind of secondary. You are attempting to provide those intervention services that has always received the most funding, the most, you know, awareness around the need for intervention. So prevention can oftentimes be very difficult to prove, right? So you have a difficult time with developing metrics. For example, training, say, 1,000 adults in how to prevent child sexual abuse, that does not necessarily correlate to 1,000 children saved. You can't accurately, you know, I guess, make that correlation. So it becomes more tricky when you're talking about prevention and being able to prove the return on investment for funders. So it's a very difficult sell in a lot of different fields when you're talking about trying to go more upstream with those solutions.
So we've talked about some of the pushback to this big systems thinking. And one of them is sometimes resources, just because, as Martin is explaining, you know, it's hard to go to a funder or a government funding agency and say, like, here's the work we've done with the money you gave us. So that's part of it. But another thing that she talked about, and this we don't talk about very much, but I think it's really important, so I'm glad she brought it up in her conversation with you, is that root causes are sometimes cloaked in various levels of shame or stigma. They are hard for people to talk about in a way that sometimes the behavior motivated by those root causes are not as difficult. Now, obviously, if you get arrested for breaking into a store, that's not your finest hour, right? That's kind of embarrassing. But it's probably easier than talking about a childhood full of parental neglect or abuse or poverty or starvation. Like, there's levels to this stuff. And the issues, the difficulty around talking about some of these root causes is a real problem. So anyway, here's Martin talking about that issue, and you'll hear her use the phrase PACES, not ACEs, And there she's talking about positive influences, which studies have shown can actually kind of course correct you even if you've had a negative childhood experience. So here's Martin.
There are several ACEs that folks are familiar with that can have lifelong consequences. However, PACEs and the beauty and the hope that go along with resilience, we can absolutely overcome those adverse childhood experiences. Adversity is absolutely not destiny. However, when you're talking about child sexual abuse in particular, sexual assault in our nation, there is so much silence, shame, and stigma surrounding this type of abuse that unfortunately the vast majority of individuals who experience this particular ACE as children, they often don't get access to those healing resources. They don't get access to those resilience-enhancing resources that can help them to move from survivor to thriver. Because they often do not come forward, they do not ever speak it into existence. Data continues to pour in over generations that this is often one of those experiences that a human being will ultimately take to their grave without ever seeking assistance for and getting healing for. And so it makes it a particularly devastating and perpetual ACE.
Yeah, and again, the statistic that she gave when I was talking to her, and statistics and facts and studies are really important in this system's thinking, because we have to rely on facts too in order to solve the problem. But she said that 1 in 10 children in the U.S. have experienced some type of sexual abuse. And online, she said this type of abuse is much higher. It's about 2 in 10, she says. And again, while funding and awareness and making sure that people are coming forward with the problem, because again, ACEs are neglect, they are poverty, they are abuse. I mean, people don't always want to say that this is what they're dealing with. It's quiet. It's they're lashing out in other ways, not dealing with it. But this group, when we talk about all these different factors, they did start coming up with some concrete steps that they wanted to take. And one of the ideas was potentially a coordinated dashboard of services. It would be interactive, because when we talked about the siloing, they talked about a lot of times nonprofits want to hold on to their data or hold on to, you know, their inner workings of the problems that they're seeing and not sharing that with a larger group so that you can approach the root work as a community.
Yeah, and I will just say, you know, especially watching the endowments, the New Hanover Community Endowments evolution over the last 4 years, this has been a big problem. And it's not always coming, it's rarely, in my experience, coming from a bad place with these nonprofits. It's one, they've been dealing with issues on their own with limited funding for so long. So they don't have the protocols and systems for sharing this information. And the second is that it has been difficult to come up with a shared framework of what data is actually important. Different nonprofits might use different rubrics, so their data set might not look like the data set for someone else, even though they're both kind of dealing with the same issue.
That's right. And here is Rebecca Martin of Not Today in the Carousel Center. She's saying what this dashboard might look like.
Also, it would allow our advocates to easily and quickly be able to see what is available, who is offering what, do they meet that criteria, as opposed to offering a family, hey, here's a list of folks, you should reach out to them, they could potentially provide that. That list might be outdated. The phone number might not be accurate. There's a lot of things that go into that. And when a human being or a family member is in a crisis state, there's a very small window of time where you have to connect them to a service. They are so overwhelmed with all that is happening. So when you want to do that handoff, when you want to get them connected to services because you know the value, you know what impact that will have in that journey, you want to make sure you do that warm handoff, because if that window closes, if they make that call and they get put on hold, or if the, you know, whatever that might look like, whatever barrier that might be the only time they make that attempt.
And the group did talk about, I went and looked at this, and you can look at it too. There is a website of community resources that the county hosts, but it's not this interactive data site that they're talking about. So it would be different. There were some ideas about Cape Fear Collective's capabilities, or would they have to create something new? I mean, that would be a large coordinated effort. And again, the siloing and the sharing, you know, might get in the way, because people are territorial, and sometimes they have to be careful, obviously, about personnel information. information. It would have to be anonymized, things like that. We deal with that a lot in the press when we're trying to report on something. But, you know, information is key to solving problems. So you need the information first so you know what to do.
Yeah, I mean, I can say we have seen some of these logistical issues rear their ugly heads with Port City United, which created a sort of community phone line. It was a hotline where you could call any time of day and someone would help you navigate through these resources. It's not that dissimilar from this dashboard idea, but there was one, an issue of people maybe not trusting, you know, a government phone line, just calling and giving them their information. And also, you know, they needed to find ways to safely share people's information. So this is a good idea, according to a lot of the people I've spoken with, but we would have to, you know, build some digital infrastructure, you know, and get people's trust, too.
That's right. And that's a systems thinking ploy. Exactly. Yeah.
So another issue that, you know, is obviously going to come up when we get into this stuff is politics, right?
That's right. Politics, because, I mean, let's be honest, it's a lot when it comes to funding initiatives. And that is one of the key points. You got to have money to do things. So the federal government, the state government, the local government, they make choices on what they think will help children in our community. And we know sometimes even philanthropic organizations, you know, their boards can be political, does that help or hinder the process? And so with Rebecca Martin, she's talking more explicitly, and I think it's helpful for a concrete example about child sexual abuse and how to prevent that.
This is not a conservative versus liberal issue. This is a public safety, public health issue. And I can't tell you how many adults come through our training who at the end say, why aren't our kids being taught that? Excellent question. Now that you know, please, please help us advocate for that. Every adult trained is a potential juror. Every adult trained has a children in their lives in some capacity. And every adult trained, you know, was a child at some point. And there are so many human beings walking around with that silent burden that we have just really focused in on educating adults. So I have seen a tremendous shift with adults who have been kind of forced to take the training through partnership, through their employers, kind of wanting all of their staff to be trained. So individuals coming in and they sit through this training, they didn't want to be there. They didn't know that it had anything to do with them. And they walk away with these incredible light bulbs and this amazing opportunity to be that adult in a child's life, to be that safe adult.
So, for example, she is asking for a policy change. She said right now that they're looking for North Carolina is one of 12 states that has not adopted what's called Allison's Law, where it requires all students kindergarten through 12th grade to know these signs of sexual abuse. And again, this is an ACE. However, the state legislature, they did recently pass a law that is mandating students in 6th through 12th grade to see this video. And I actually saw it at the safety conference that Department of Public Instruction put on about grooming, about how it happens. And it was age appropriate, and it is a law. So the legislature is doing something, but it's politics plays a lot into what laws get passed and what gets funded. And that's a reality.
Yeah, and we know, obviously, people are going to hear certain words when we're talking about certain issues and react, maybe without understanding the granular details. You know, for example, people say grooming, and people hear the culture war debates that we've heard over books and libraries over the last couple of years. And, you know, this video was really about specifically how adults, you know, inculcate kids into inappropriate sexual situations. You know, we're not talking about a book that people might debate the content of. You know, it was, I feel like most people, when they saw that video, they'd be like, oh, well, yeah.
Right. And we know through your coverage and my coverage, I mean, we had real cases of child sex abuse in the schools through Michael Kelly, through Peter Frank, through Nicholas Oates. And, you know, you can go and look at those stories, and those things did happen. Yes, you know, statistically slim, but it still impacted several victims and it broke trust in our community. And so this is an education piece. So we see that.
So before we leave the world of politics, you know, part of your role with this group was to, you know, interview people. And one of the people you spoke to was our representative, Deb Butler. And you were asking her about, you know, is there anything really bipartisan happening in the General Assembly on this front?
Yes. Representative Deb Butler, she's a Democrat, and she said there are, again, siloing. There's no big, you know, systemic move to really get at economic inequality, or if there's no big systemic things that are tackling ACEs or one of the ACEs. But we do have, for example, Chief Justice Paul Newby, and I reported on this, he started a ACEs-informed courts. It's more about being aware of the person's story and more of the rehabilitation process, or treating them like a human in court.
Okay, so one last issue we got to get into before we end the show is economic disparity. And we've touched on it here and there in the show, and it comes up in every conversation I have about community safety. It's always in the background. But it looks a very specific way here in Wilmington and New Hanover County, in fact, much of coastal North Carolina, where we see, very affluent neighborhoods, and we also see a robust tourist economy. And as someone who's worked in that tourist economy, I can tell you there's a real, economic segregation that's happening there. The people who are working in the kitchens are not living the same quality of life as the people who are eating in the dining room.
Yeah, and part of this causal loop map, it caused me to question, okay, so you had tourism had a positive impact on family economic security. And I was thinking, wait a minute, I need to ask clarification on that point, on that connection. And I talked to Dr. Musim Katapi. He's a UNCW economist. And I brought this to him. And we talked about tax revenue from tourism. Could that be a possibility?
But I know that different parts of the country, of the world, deal with tourism taxes differently. Some of them are earmarked for specific things. There has been quite a bit of concerted effort, for example, in ski resort areas to try and build worker-type housing. So they're taking some of the money and allocating it to make sure that workers have decent places to live. But clearly, it's place by place, and most places tend to wait till it becomes a crisis or where recruitment becomes really challenging for them to respond in a way that kind of makes a dent in this question.
Yeah, and he said that these tourism jobs, they tend to be low paying. So if you're trying to prevent childhood, adverse experiences, and poverty is one of those, We need to talk about the minimum wage is still at $7.25, and I put this to Representative Butler, and she said, of course, she wants to protect small businesses, but this is not good for local workers. She's not saying to jump that to $20 an hour, but to talk to economists how to phase in something that's responsible that, certain businesses could do. Another thing that Dr. Katapi said is that if you have tourism revenue, hopefully it will stay in the community instead of a large conglomerate coming in, taking all the profits and pulling it out. It really, in economics, where is the money going? And that's what you have to ask when you're looking at tourism being a base for economic security in our community.
Yeah, and we could do a whole other podcast on this. And if you know us, we probably will. But let me just say this. I've talked to a lot of people about ACEs and, the disparities in our community. And I don't think a lot of people disagree with kind of the underlying idea that economics plays a big role here. And that when you see concentrations of poverty, you see concentrations of crime. And I don't just mean that that's where criminals live. I mean, that's where people are subjected to crime. They're the victims of crime. And if you want to reduce crime, reducing economic inequality seems like a pretty good way to do it. I haven't had a ton of pushback on that argument. Now, again, some people lean more into the personal responsibility. Some people lean more into like the root cause stuff. But I think there's some agreement here. Now, when it comes to how you actually help people out of poverty, yeah, you're going to see a lot of differences, right? You've got your free market Reagan capitalists, you got your Bernie Sanders, and there's a lot of space in between. So I don't think it's that people don't care or don't understand this kind of theoretical approach and how it really shows up in the real world. But there are going to be some people who say, okay, let's just raise the minimum wage. But again, you could triple the minimum wage and it still wouldn't give you enough revenue income to live in New Hanover County. Making $21, $22 an hour is not going to be enough to live in New Hanover County, let alone raise a family. There has to be some way to rise up through the ranks, become the chef, open your own business, or, translate the skills you learn in the kitchen, dedication, creative profanity, whatever you learned in the kitchen, and translate that into a different career. There has to be pathways to better jobs with, more of a vertical, employment ladder. So there are people who are like, okay, let's give people economic opportunity. Let's make sure that there are jobs for people to have that don't just look like dishwasher or CFO, right? That we have some middle class, which is as I think we all kind of agree, heavily eroded. So that's one approach. There are people who think direct subsidies are the way, you know, whether that's housing vouchers or, you know, meal cards or even reparations when we're talking about the racial disparities in our town. I don't expect anyone to agree on any of the things I just said as being the solution. I think everyone agrees what the problem is. So maybe optimistically we could say we're halfway there, but at least we understand kind of what's going on.
Yes. And before we end the program, I watched this documentary. It was from PBS's Nova, and they do a lot of scientific programs on there. And it was called The Paradox of Violence. And so they were talking about the studies that prove predictors for violence, which was one of our community's focus points.
But aggregate data can only tell you so much. For example, taking the U.S. as a whole, homicide rates have declined dramatically to about 5 deaths per 100,000 people per year. But when you drill down, you find that some cities have rates up to 10 times higher.
We tend to think of this phenomena as affecting all people equally, but the reality when it comes to, say, homicide or terrorism is that it's hyper-concentrated in time, space, and among certain communities.
Why are some places more violent than others? What can the past tell us about violence today? History suggests that some of the factors driving violence down are a strong government, education, and equality. But those conditions are not evenly distributed today.
Income inequality has a very strong statistical relationship with overall levels of homicide.
In fact, income inequality is one of the strongest predictors for violence.
So, dramatic music aside, I think that makes the point really well. I think we understand that, you know, not every ACE is caused by economic inequality. Not every crime is the result of economic inequality. But it is a huge factor in the overall quality of life in our community, and it's worth thinking about how to address it. And I think what this group was getting at is that there have been a lot of efforts that have been piecemeal or siloed or underfunded or have been trying to help someone who's trying to afford groceries today without the capacity to figure out why they can't afford groceries in general. So I appreciate their big picture approach to this. And you've told me that there are some next steps.
Yes, and the next steps are mainly up to this core team. And their hope is to kind of work through more of the causal loop analysis and to kind of finalize either this dashboard or another idea that they want to do. And Javenay Skiba of the New Hanover County Task Force, I said, after the grant is over, it's over, right? And she said, oh, no, we're going to continue this work through the Resiliency Task Force. There might be potential for an endowment ask for something because they've done a lot of research. They've had UNC Chapel Hill researchers helping them do this. They're going to be a professional research-based report at the end of this. So that's all to come. Will people in the community listen to them? Will they pick up some of their ideas? They know they want to keep working on this root work while they're doing, you know, the intervention, the Band-Aid stuff too. But again, we got to have the system in mind when we're doing the intervention work is what they're saying.
Well, I know that you'll be following the issue and that there'll be more reporting to come. But for now, Rachel Keith, thanks for being here.
Thank you.
All right, well, that's all the time we have for this edition of The Newsroom. Thanks to my colleague, Rachel Keith, and her guests, Rebecca Martin, Javenay Skiba, Shaquana Pulliam, and Keisha Robinson. Thanks also to Ken Campbell, our trusty and beloved program director. Music for this episode was recorded by If These Trees Could Talk and Blue Dot Sessions. If you missed any part of this show, you can find it at whqr.org or as a podcast, pretty much everywhere you can find podcasts. If you have questions, comments, or an idea for a future show, contact us at newsroom@whqr.org. I'm Ben Shockman. Thanks for listening, and I hope you'll join us on the next edition of The Newsroom.